does the government appreciate what is needed? No, they really don't yet. And, you know, they kind of put these little kind of carrots on a stick in front of you, you know, kind of, well, look, we'll look after dad if, no, it's having a baby is a family process. You know, in the large majority of cases, it took two people to make that baby. Obviously, you've got to take IVF and everything into consideration. But the fact is, there's nearly always two parents, whether that be same sex, mother and father, father and father, however it works. And the equality and the care they're receiving during conception, pregnancy, birth, and then after birth is far from equal. And it's far from what it should be, what it could be, but more importantly, what it needs to be.
Welcome to the show. I'm Joe Horton. On the Guild of Dads show, we unwrap weekly the incredible stories, skills, and expertise of the world's most captivating dads and experts, along with topics and stories that will captivate you and impact your life. If you're an existing listener, then thanks for your ongoing support of the podcast. I'm really grateful to you for diving into the conversations that I'm having on a regular basis. If you have just discovered the podcast, then welcome to the show. Check back through the past episodes, as I'm sure there'll be something that will pique your interest. To you guys, dads that listen, you motivate and inspire me to forge ahead with Guild of Dads and help as many dads as I can through the conversations that I have. There are a couple of ways you can get involved with Guild of Dads movement. You can reach out to me on Instagram, Facebook and Twitter. I'm doing quite a lot on Twitter right now, so you can get engaged over there. Or also, just drop me an email, joe@guildofdads.com. I've had some really nice messages from those of you that listen in and have been impacted by the podcast, which is really humbling for me. You can also join our rapidly growing free Facebook group and join the Guild. Over in there, you'll find a positive, encouraging community of other dads on life's journey, all looking to lift each other up. I'm very pleased to say that my message was resonating. A message of personal growth and brotherhood, and celebrating men and dads, along with the far-reaching impact we can have on society. I'm proud to be on this journey with you guys and leading this movement. So what do you get on this podcast? Each week we deliver content and conversations that will expand what you think is possible for yourself, enabling you to positively impact yourself, all areas of your life, and the lives of those that surround you. We do this by speaking to fascinating individuals, best-selling authors, entrepreneurs, and ultra athletes, professors, psychologists, and also some ordinary mums and dads just like you doing some extraordinary and impactful things. Every episode will give you either actionable resources to take away or a different perspective on a particular topic. These conversations are important and necessary because the world is changing. The role of dads and men is constantly under the spotlight, sometimes even under attack. And my dream is to make Guild of Dads the go-to resource for dads like you who want to make some changes in your life and live lives of vision, action, and meaning. So what's today's episode about? Today I'm talking about male suicide. This is one of the most difficult parts of mental health to discuss. We know it, we're aware of it, and some of us have come close to it. It's the biggest killer of men under the age of 45. Men are three times as likely to take their own lives as women, and the highest risk group is in the 45 to 49 year old age group, who are quite often dads. The impact on those left behind is immense. Their wives and partners, their children, and society as a whole. So that's what today's episode is about, both the impact it has and what we can begin to do about it. Today I speak to a mum who is bereaved by their partner's suicide and now campaigns for those suffering trauma following birth, and co-founder of the Paternal Mental Health Alliance, Helen Birch. Helen is also an MSc student, mental health recovery and social inclusion, and a breastfeeding peer supporter and a specialist trainer, mental health awareness, suicide intervention, prevention and postvention and self-harm for Harmless CIC. I'm massively appreciative to Helen for joining me on this episode and speaking about what was an incredibly difficult thing for her to go through. And now to my conversation with Helen. Helen, welcome to the Guild of Dads podcast.
Hi, Joe. It's great to be here. Thank you.
Great to have you here. We first linked up over on Twitter because you're operating in the men's perinatal mental health space, which for anyone who doesn't know what that means, it means the period just after a man and his partner or wife have had children. You ended up in this space, I know, through kind of circumstances that you weren't really expecting, but can you just tell the people that are listening how you actually ended up doing what you're doing in the first place?
Yeah, absolutely. Like you say, I definitely never expected to be where I am. And it's a roller coaster of a journey. Sadly, I didn't know I was on the roller coaster until the end. But me and my partner, we've been together a while, and we decided we wanted to extend our blended family. So we looked to conceive, and we did that nice and quickly, which is lovely. But then sadly, we suffered a miscarriage for that pregnancy, and I had to go to hospital. I was looked after really well, but with hindsight, neither of us were given any brochures or leaflets or charities to contact, just to talk through our experience and our loss. This is not something my partner had ever experienced before either. So I think it would have been really beneficial for us to talk through that, but that wasn't an option we were given. So we then tried to conceive again, and this happened. This was our no complications pregnancy and birth. That's our son, who's going to be 7 very soon. Love him. He's amazing. So even during that process, though, I was looked after really well, and I'm not saying my partner wasn't. But again, with hindsight, I don't ever remember my partner being addressed or asked if he had any concerns, any anxieties, any worries, or excitement, you know, kind of anything on the scale, at scans, antenatal appointments, or during the labour process, really. I mean, because his children were quite a lot older. So in all intents and purposes, it was like the first one again, and it was quite a big gap for me as well for my last child, so it was almost like the first again, and you know, having additional support would have been great, although the, you know, the team were fantastic, I'm not saying they're not, but you know, hindsight. So then we were enjoying our son Connell, and we thought we'll have another one, so got pregnant nice and quick again. Sadly, at 6 weeks I suffered a really large bleed. So we went to the GP and we were told we'd suffered another miscarriage. I kind of had a feeling, though, that I was still pregnant, and I did ask to be sent for a scan, but the GP said, no, you know, you've had one before, you know what, you know, there's no point doing a scan, you know what's happened. But we will do the human growth hormone blood test for you in a week or so. So fast forward, had the blood test. Those growth hormones were skyrocketing, so that just showed that I was still pregnant. We were then sent to the hospital for a scan, which confirmed it. There was a fetus, heartbeat, they could see the area where the bleed was, but there was you know, another live baby. So if you look at that over a time period, over a couple of years, we had both gone through a miscarriage, a pregnancy and birth, a pregnancy which we then thought we'd lost, and then found out we hadn't lost. That's a lot to process for anyone. And, you know, if you haven't been asked any questions directly as to how are you, Dad, you know, I think there's something missing there. So 2 weeks after the scan that confirmed our baby was still okay, my partner walked out of our house and was never seen alive again. He completed suicide. So from that moment, I knew I had to do something to make sure that the world my children grow up in looks after fathers much more adequately than they do currently. I need to make sure that both my, you know, my sons and my daughter receive the care that works for them, receive the care that they deserve during this critical time period. And that is what led me to where I am right now, Joe.
And did you get any kind of indication or inclination, or was there any warning signs at all? Or was there anything you could kind of pinpoint in terms of your partner and what he was going through, or because the reason I say it is because I know, having interviewed guys, I interviewed a guy recently called Chris Whitfield, who runs an organization called Miscarriage for Men. And just to kind of plug that kind of gap that he saw. And he said to me, he said, the thing is that the guys just, a lot of the guys that he is interacting with now, you know, these miscarriages happened decades ago and they've never, ever spoken to anyone about it, sort of thing. It's kind of, but it's still a bereavement, and it's still like you still in your mind pictured the life you're going to have with this new unborn child. And when it doesn't happen, that kind of changes what you thought the trajectory of your life or your relationship and your family was going to be, sort of thing. But a lot of guys don't really get an opportunity to talk about it at all. So,
yeah, I mean, so you saying all of that, that's actually brought back a memory that I haven't had for quite a while. Give me a minute. So we were on the way back after the bleed, and we were in a car, and we were just pulling into a petrol station to get some chocolate. Chocolate fixes everything, you know. And my partner went to cry, and I looked at him, and then he just kind of shook it off, and he went, "Oh, I nearly cried." I was like, "You can," he said. "I've just never done this before. I don't know how to do this." And that was that was a tiny little kind of almost verbalizing, processing how he was feeling. But that's as far as he got because of how he was, I don't know, programmed just to keep it all in. It never got any further than that. And hindsight, I hate hindsight with a passion. It's such a horrible thing. That could have been my invitation to start a conversation. But also, you know, if services had something in place and had given us some information, even if they'd just given me the information, because I didn't really know about, you know, all the places you could go to reach out for help with regards to miscarriage. So, yeah, I had that's one of those ones that I think I'd pushed to the back of my mind. That's really just brought that home, actually. And, I mean, other warning signs, again, hindsight, such a horrible thing. Yeah, not sleeping. So we had lots of sleep deprivation. And if I put two and two together, I might be making five. But I'm thinking he was up not just after miscarriage, after our son as well, thinking, God, can I do this? Am I good enough for this? Am I going to be a good enough father? Can I provide? Can I do this? Am I good enough? And I think, you know, I would say my partner wasn't scared of anyone or anything. The heartbreaking thing is, it turns out the one thing he was scared of was himself. And I think not being able to provide or be the man, the father, to his sons. So, yeah, there were kind of signs, but they weren't something I understood as signs. There was one kind of conversation beforehand that pointed to the desperation, I suppose, he was in. But again, because suicide and male mental health, especially perinatal mental health, isn't a conversation that you have unless you've literally just been launched into it through your own lived experience or one of your loved ones, you just don't have the knowledge or the education, how to recognize the signs, how to act upon the signs, and how to have a conversation about it. Suicide to me was fear invoking. And when I get scared, you know, it just makes me a bit shouty and a bit, you know, because I'm so scared. And also, you don't believe that it's going to happen. You never believe it's going to happen. You don't believe that your partner's going to walk out and take their own life. You can't see that as an option. Unless you have been suicidal yourself, you can't believe that's an option because your brain's not programmed for that. So, yeah, there probably were lots of warning signs. But due to lack of education and everything, it's not something I you know, we actions really.
Yeah. And the thing is, as well, is being fair to people that kind of have got relatives or partners or people that have taken their own life. I think I know, having spoken to people, that it's something they kind of go over in their mind that, you know, could I have done this or could I have done that? And there's this kind of, it induces kind of quite a lot of kind of rumination in terms of, you know, what, you know, could I have done something different or could this? And almost, it's almost kind of an act of kind of giving yourself permission to actually know, I'm not a trained mental health professional. And in the absence of any formal training to understand what was going on, it's kind of a bit like, assuming that someone can, I don't know, drive an articulated lorry, having not had any training to drive an articulated lorry, and then wondering why it doesn't kind of end well. And I think that this speaks to, I think it speaks to a lot of the actual experience of not just being a parent, but also just being a human being, really, in the sense that you don't really get like a Haynes manual when you hit 18 to say, right, this is what you do. This is what you do when you have kids. This is what you do when you lose someone. This is what you do when this happens. So what happens is, I think, and I notice this more and more with guys than more, the more and more I work with guys, is that I think that we tend to, first of all, we pull the ripcord on our parachute when we're about to hit the ground. So first and foremost, we don't reach out for help until it's about to, you know, the wheels are coming off the car. But I think as well, I think that inevitably we use whatever coping mechanisms we can in order to get through whatever life situation throws at us. And, you know, you jokingly mentioned chocolate and stuff, but I think that with men, we find a way through and kind of muddle our way through. And it's not until you look back on situations that you think, actually, I probably, had I had the information I have now, I would have dealt with that differently, or I'd have handled that differently. But that's kind of a wisdom, and the kind of like a, that's something that comes from wisdom and the rites of passage of kind of growing older, I think. And
yeah. And that's another reason why I'm on this journey that I'm on now, because, you know, I've learned this stuff. I've got, you know, as you say, that this nugget of wisdom, and I'll keep on shouting out about it. You know, so as many people can hear it and can use it, you know, can learn from it, and we can start changing practices and just general how we go about daily everything, really. Because you're saying about that, you know, we don't get this manual when we're 18, but I don't think we even give the groundwork to children growing up before they're 18. I mean, schools are a lot better now at, you know, dealing, well, talking about mental well-being, you know, so how to talk, how to, the five ways to well-being. So what's that? Be active, keep learning, give, connect, and take notice. And if you've got preventative measures in place within your young children, it's got to be beneficial. So when they do hit that kind of adulthood moment, and when they do go on to have a family, they are not, like, literally hit in the face by a brick wall at 100 miles an hour when something goes wrong, because they've got the foundations in on how to have slightly more healthy coping mechanisms. Because if you haven't shown anyone how to live life, how do you expect people to form relationships, to start a family, and then horrifically stillbirth, miscarriage, all sorts of things, if they haven't got the basic coping mechanisms in? How the hell are they supposed to deal with that? You know, and it's just a huge gap that we have missed historically. I do think going forward we're getting better, but just harking back to the conversations we've had before, you know, kind of like you say, homogenizing men and women, we need to really recognize that, you know, men and women are different, and we're different for a reason. And, you know, mental well-being is, it is a generic thing, but we need to look more closely at how we verbalise this and the different ways to well-being, because what some men want will be very different to what some women want, and we just need to give everyone options that are applicable to them going forward.
Mm. There's one word that you mentioned, I think you possibly mentioned it, is about kind of this kind of feeling that men have that they need to be able to provide, and they need to be this and they need to be that. One of the things that comes up, the word that I hear a lot from men more than anything else, is I don't feel like I'm worthy. And yeah. and it's always a really weird thing, but what I wanted to do is link that back to what you were talking about in terms of, you know, appointments and stuff, because my experience and the experience of a lot of men whose wives get pregnant and they go through, you know, they go to the midwife's appointments and stuff. What my experience of it was, and, you know, I was talking to Mark Williams about this, is that often it's, oh yeah, we want to get dads involved, and it's really good for dads to be involved and whatever. But then when you go and turn up to appointments and stuff, it's really...
Who's that man in the room?
the glow is around mum, which obviously it should be, but there's this kind of, it's, yes, if you could just sit there, please, in the corner, or if you could, and it's a hard thing to explain, but there's two strands to how kind of men are kind of looked at, not just in the kind of perinatal space, but just in general. One is this kind of sort of like, well, you're not, to use this word, worthy. You're not worthy to be here. So we're going to reinforce that by making you
a lack of engagement. There's absolutely no engagement to dads, is there?
Yeah. So you're told to sit in a corner, and it's kind of like, you're almost being treated like a naughty boy, if that makes any sense, yeah, for actually being there and actually having the audacity to be there. And you're like, well, hang on a minute. You said it's great that we're involved, but hang on a minute. When I do show up and I do turn up, I'm kind of sort of, so that plays into this whole, you know, that this word, I don't feel worthy. Well, if someone's not making you feel worthy of being there, then there's no way you're going to feel worthy, is there, sort of thing. But the other thing as well that I notice in this space is that, and again, I, being a dad in this, working with other dads, and the thing that I hear frequently is that some elements, and I'm going to be polite about how I say this, but some elements are quite condescending towards guys working in this space. It's kind of like you get a pat on the head for being, it's like, oh, you're working with Ben. Oh, that's really worthwhile. And it's almost like said to you in a condescending way, like it's kind of, let's give you a pat on the head for being a good boy, for working with men, sort of thing. And it's kind of, it's a really peculiar thing that I can't put my finger on, but
you've been patronised, haven't you? I think.
It's a bit patronised. We're a bit sort of being patronised, and the irony of it is that I think that, you know, for years and years, men were like, oh, women were very much like, well, I don't like being patronised by men who are kind of sort of like, you do yourself a favour, love, and you don't really know what you're talking about, sort of thing. It's almost like the script's been flipped at the moment, and it's the kind of other way around, which is kind of peculiar.
There's a lot of stories we hear. I do Maternal Mental Health Alliance, and that's with Mark. He's a great guy. I'm sure that was a great podcast. And the stories we're getting back from dads, you know, there's so many, too many to mention. I mean, you know, dad's taking their little ones for immunisations, and then the nurse saying, oh, just get mum to call back to book the next ones. Or literally, physically, the dad walks in with a baby and they're looking for mum, like they've lost something. And it's like, he's the dad, you know, it takes two to make these people. Or just environments and spaces. So like you say, you're going for a scan or something and you're an afterthought. They're like, oh, well, we haven't got a chair for you, you know, just over there. Or there's not enough room in the scanning rooms, or if dad brings up any worries or anything, oh, you know, you've just got to look after mum, you know, that's fine. And there's no space in the notes to write any of dad's concerns down or anything. So it really has been an afterthought. I mean, when in the context of time, dads haven't even been allowed in the delivery room for that long, have they? You know, so it's all kind of like, oh, shock horror, men. And I think that's kind of perpetuated. It's like, it's malaise, isn't it? It's carried on and on and on and on. It's a bit like language, it takes a long time to change, and so do thought processes and practices, because the conversation is only one or two generations away that men weren't allowed in the delivery room. And it's the same with terms like committed suicide. We don't say that anymore, but that was only decriminalised in 1961. So again, that's only one or two generations away. And that's why we've got so much work to do to break these conversations and these kind of stigmas and biases and get rid of this marginalisation. You know, there is so much that we need to do, but absolutely, currently, men in the large part are completely marginalized and seen as an add-on.
And we saw this during the pandemic as well, didn't we? You know, the first thing to be jettisoned in the pandemic was, oh yeah, you can't come into the hospital with your wife, sort of thing. And you just think, come on, in the whole scheme of things, would it really make that much difference for dad to come in and be involved? You know, yeah. Understand we're, yeah, in the middle of pandemic.
Just do the test on mum, the test on dad and everything. And that really did highlight it. And you know, I'm always let's try and get the best out of a bad situation. And COVID and the way, you know, the whole of it was just horrific. And the exclusion of dad was horrific. And the impact it's going to have and is having is huge. And that's been highlighted in the Maternal Mental Health Alliance report that they did, which I actually used to email my MP, highlighting again the disparities and the issues this is going to cause, the trauma that's been caused to the mums, having to go through awful things by themselves. Dad's being left in car parks for days and days and days, you know, saying if they go home, they're then not allowed in the hospital for the birth because of the clothes change and everything. And it's just ridiculous. But as horrific as it is, it's really given us a catalyst to move forward and just show that these disparities were there beforehand. And that's why it was so easy to say, Dad, you're not allowed in. No, Dad, you can't come. No, Dad, you're not part of this. And, you know, moving forward, this is, you know, we need to not sit on our laurels and keep moving forward and highlighting and highlighting and highlighting and emailing our MPs, doing these talks, you know, just getting out there that we need to do better for, not just for dads, but this is for families, you know, by bringing everyone together, we're actually supporting the family unit and therefore the next generations. So they don't have to live through these disparities and inequalities. You know, I kind of liken it to a table. You've got four legs on a table. You've got mum, dad, child, mental health. That's nice and stable. Remove any one of them, and you've got something that is completely unstable and eventually will possibly collapse, you know, and we need to remember that. So currently we've got a three-legged table because dad is not part, you know, part of the perinatal process. And this needs to be addressed, you know, right from when you're wanting to conceive all the way through. They go up to over 2 years now within perinatal fields because they've recognised they need to extend the period. So people can actually access the kind of support that they need and time for any issues to develop, you know, because it doesn't happen instantly. It's not a quick thing. Sometimes, you know, kind of these mental illnesses can build up over a slow time period. And obviously men can hide it for quite a long time. We've got so much to do.
I think what's interesting as well that I've noticed, and because again, what I find is that when you begin to sort of take apart some of this stuff, you know, you mentioned dads again, and I agree with this. My experience is that when dads are on kind of fire, everyone glows in that, everyone, you know, beams in that glow, if that makes any sense. So, we know, I won't go over it in this call, but we know the statistics around dads being present and dads being there and, you know, the outcomes in terms of the family unit and the children. We know all those benefits in terms of criminology and those, all these different areas. Mm-hmm. They've been well versed. So it's not like no one doesn't know about this stuff. But yeah, one thing that's kind of come up recently, and I discussed it with previous guests of mine, Connor Beaton, on last week's podcast, is that I think that there is like a, there's like a perfect storm that occurs kind of, I'm going to say midlife, because generally guys are having kids later. So between 35, 45 and 50. And I think what happens is guys have got this, well, happily ever after story in their head, which is I'm going to settle down, I'm going to have kids, and that is going to be what I'm going to aim for in life. But the problem is that having kids is a really joyous thing to happen, but your kind of life plan stops. It's like a cliff. You know, you have kids and then it's kind of like, okay, so what happens then? And there is this kind of no man's land, I think, which guys are hitting them, because I think guys are having kids particularly later. Guys in men and women are having kids later. I think that there is this kind of no man's land which occurs after childbirth, which guys just really aren't sort of prepared for. Because if your life plan was to, like, you know, you have kids and that, and also I think people place a lot of reliance in the obtaining of things to make them happy. And if you've had this kind of what should be joyous event, and you should be feeling really good and, you know, really pumped about your life with your new baby or whatever. When you don't feel like that, and you're actually thinking, well, what does this mean now, sort of thing, and I'm not feeling all these feelings I should have, that's kind of mind-blowing for a lot of guys. And it's just, and a lot of the kind of skills that we talked about coping mechanisms, a lot of the skills that you may have acquired in, say, your 20s and 30s or whatever and stuff, and, you know, when life gets stressful, I go out drinking or I go out taking drugs or I go out doing whatever, you can't do that when you've got kids. You have to be more kind of responsible. So you're then like, well, actually, how do I cope with all these very strong emotions and, you know, very strong feelings? And again, back to that toolkit and the kind of Haynes manual, we don't have a Haynes manual. It's kind of like, right, okay, yeah. So what do I do now? You know what I mean?
Yeah, no, definitely. And I think, I mean, obviously, I can never say anything with certainty with my partner because he's the only one with the answers. But he kind of fits all of that. You know, he was older, you know, he'd... And I think it was a case of... We'd had Connell, and then it was, oh, God. You know, like I say, what do I do now? How, like I say, where was he going with it? What was he going to do? And his old coping mechanisms would be going out and drinking and et cetera. And although near the end he was going out drinking quite a lot, and again, that probably was, well, it was really, wasn't it? It's a known kind of warning sign. I agree with what you've said, and I don't really know how to verbalise it other than it's a real thing that you're saying. This is really what's happening, and we somehow need to address this better, not just as a society but within government. And I think they need to be doing a lot more than they're doing, and recognising and taking seriously the struggle, I suppose, for dads, because you've been living your life kind of going along happily. Like you say, you've got your plan, or, you know, you've got your mates, your pub, and you've got all of that stuff, and then all of a sudden you've got this human being who relies on you solely, and everything you thought changes, and all the ways you've previously coped or planned now have this human there. and how do we move on? Can we move on from this? How do I provide? How do I transition from this man up to this point to maybe your dad, you know? And even if you have previous children, like my partner, like I say, there was such a long gap that it becomes new again. I'd imagine you've got more information, kind of understanding of this being
Gents, I'm going to jump into the conversation here very quickly. You've probably heard me mention that putting out a regular podcast involves a substantial investment of both time and money to make it happen. Guild of Dads isn't sponsored, and I'm 100% self-funded. So I've recently set up a service called Ko-Fi, which means if you like and appreciate what I'm doing with the Guild of Dads podcast and Facebook group, or even if you want to follow me on social media, then you can buy me a coffee to say thanks and support my work. Just head on over to guildofdads.com and you'll see a small coffee cup at the bottom left-hand side of the screen entitled Donate. You can also follow me on there, so I'll be posting updates and some other cool stuff just to let you know what I'm up to. Any of you guys helping to support the podcast and group by donating will get a shout out on both platforms as my thanks to you for getting behind what I'm doing. If you ever wonder how some of my amazing guests get to where they are in life, the athletes, the entrepreneurs, those making a massive impact on the world, I can tell you that pretty much all of them follow a very deliberate plan or system of some kind. This is exactly what I do too, and I'm revealing how you can implement a plan and system in your own life completely free in my ebook, The Dad Blueprint, over at guildofdads.com/dad. Incidentally, many of the people I interview on this show will be leveraging the power of similar systems to radically level up their lives and transform into the men and dads they always wanted to be. So you'll be in amazing company. And now back to today's conversation.
Yeah,
and I think the thing is, what I noticed the most, and one thing that I pinpointed the most, and listeners of the podcast won't be surprised by what I'm about to say, I think that guys go through a bit of an existential crisis when they're in this stage, and I think it does evolve around meaning, and it does evolve around purpose, because obviously you have to reset your compass as to what direction your life is going after.
Yeah, that's a good way of saying it.
And I think the problem is that guys don't get any guidance or tutelage. It's almost like there needs to be a mentorship of guys that are slightly older than you that have navigated that bit of life to say, right, okay, so life's going to change a little bit. So where do you see your life going? How are you going to connect with your kids? You know, what things are you going to do as your self-care, your mental health self-care, if you like? Now your responsibilities are there, yeah. And how are you?
So it's like peer guidanceship, isn't it? You know, peer support, as it were.
And I think that's happening more.
Within perinatal, that needs to be something that we get into the leaflets and the brochures and the posters on the wall. So the dads going round to the hospitals are privy to that information during, while, and then after the pregnancy and birth process, so it's not such a shock. And that's something else that really needs to be addressed, because I mean, currently there isn't really much dad focused literature within regards to the perinatal field, and then that would address, it wouldn't completely address that gap obviously, but it would be a starting point. And like we're talking about you know, young children in school, it's the same for adults. You just need that base information. It's just like a starting block, isn't it? You know, kind of, oh, okay, I've read a bit about that, or I saw that on the poster, and it reduces the alone feeling, and it gives you that little nugget of information that might just stop you falling so far backwards or falling off the cliff. It might enable you to reach out and seek further information, to find other peers, or to just verbalize it, you know, because it's a thing, it's real, and that is huge. And I mean, I'm just,
some of the stuff is, and some of the stuff is actually, a lot of it just comes down to guys actually thinking, because one of the things I think, again, for gents, is I'm the only one going through this. And I think when you begin to sort of speak to other people and realize that you're not the only one going through this, in actual fact, and this can be as simple as, for argument's sake, your wife's gone through a particularly traumatic birth, and and there is bonding issues between her and baby and you and baby, or it could be that there's bonding issues between you and your wife, because for obvious reasons, men and women aren't always that intimate for the months afterwards. And, you know, one thing that comes up with dads often is, well, I like to kind of, you know, I like to be sort of intimate with my wife, and I found it difficult in the few months afterwards. I appreciate that she's not going to, because she's kind of, women are kind of often quite touched out, is the, because they've got baby all over them, that the last thing they want is, you know, being intimate with their husbands. But again, it's little things like that, okay, it's perfectly normal, mate, but what will happen is you just need to do stuff slightly differently, be a bit more patient and stuff, and just get that kind of reassurance that although your wife is kind of distant from you at the moment, that provided you do these certain things, and this is not about getting your wife back into bed, it's about forming those connections that husband and wife
reestablishing.
And the thing is again, if guys have never, that's the first and maybe only time they're ever going to experience this. So actually, so what do I do? How do I approach this without being a completely insensitive idiot sort of thing? But the thing is guys don't generally talk about this. My wife's not too into it. How do I kind of, how do I navigate this period? I don't want to come on too strong. But it's little things like this that, and this is just one example.
Starting those conversations,
that
can be seen as quite hard and awkward and a bit. Oh.
Yeah, yeah, and I think that, and that's just one kind of specific thing. But there's another thing that kind of often we went through it as well is when you've just had a kid and the house looks like a bomb's hit it sort of thing, and you're like, oh, no, I must make sure that it's all cleaned to with it, sterilized within its life, because someone might turn up for a cup of tea, or my mum and dad might come over and they might judge me because of how filthy the house is.
Unrealistic expectations of parenthood, especially in those first months. Wow. Yeah. I mean, you're amazing if you get dressed in the first months.
Well, again, it's this perfectionist mentality of the modern world, isn't it? That we have to do everything perfect and, people are going to judge us if whatever. And the bottom line is this. Okay, in the first couple of weeks, you're going to have a pristine pushchair and you're going to be going around and smiling in the sunshine about how lovely your baby is. But you are going to be exhausted and you are going to feel terrible at points, and you are going to have baby sick all over your new shirt that you've just bought.
You're going to have to change bed sheets because of those midnight nappy changes where it all goes terribly wrong.
Yeah.
And you've got to strip the bed sheets and stuff and be like, oh.
Yeah. It doesn't look like a mama's and papa's commercial. It really
no, it's quite often not pretty. The baby's beautiful, but everything else around it, you're like,
So what do you think are the, we touched upon this before we jumped on air today. What are you seeing as the kind of main challenges at the moment in this space? Because you're on the kind of front line in terms of, lobbying governments and MPs about what should be happening. Does your experience kind of echo what we've been discussing in the last few minutes on this?
So those on the ground understand what's needed and are living through the inequalities and the huge gaps in services, and my life is testament to that. There is a huge gap in perinatal mental health that needs addressing when it comes to looking after dads, and those on the ground, we try to put into place with grassroots, with these type of conversations, with lobbying to our MPs, with doing peer support work within hospitals, trying to bridge these gaps, which is great, and we do loads, we do so much, but there's only so much we can do until the government steps up and gives us backing and starts putting fathers into pathways, policies, procedures, etc. And that, I mean, that kind of brings me nicely to a recent correspondent that I've got from Nadine Dorris. So I email my MP a lot. I mean, he's probably really annoyed with me, but no, he's a great guy actually. He sends everything off for me, and he's doing quite a lot actually to try and help. So I've got a 3-page reply and it's very detailed, which is great, but not really a lot for dads in there. Now, the email I sent over was highlighting the disparities. Again, it was actually using the COVID Maternal Mental Health Alliance report as a basis to highlight the disparities as we went over. And the letter just, we remain committed to improving mental health services, not only during the current pandemic, the NHS long-term plan includes commitment for a further amount of women. And then it goes on and on and on and on and on about maternal mental health, which is vital. And, you know, I'm never trying to take the limelight or the money or the services away from mothers. You know, without them, I don't know where I'd be without the specialist team that looks after me after I lost my partner.
Of course.
But only, I reckon there's probably about one sentence in there about dads, and that is that dads will be able to access mental health support if their partner is already under the specialist mental health team. My partner would never have got that because I wasn't under the specialist mental health team until we lost him to suicide. We could be picking up a lot more paternal mental health crises before they become crises, before the family has broken down, before the dad has become unwell, before that man has gone and completed suicide. And this really needs addressing. We really need NICE to take this up and, you know, get paternal mental health in the NICE guidelines. And this just isn't happening yet. I mean, so like I say, on the ground, we know what's needed. And yes, I mean, changes really are happening. But the fact is, it's still a huge postcode lottery to what type of care you get as a mother, let alone as a father. But does the government appreciate what is needed? No, they really don't yet. And, you know, they kind of put these little kind of carrots on a stick in front of you, you know, kind of, we'll look after dad if no, it's having a baby is a family process, you know. In the large majority of cases, it took two people to make that baby. Obviously, you've got to take IVF and everything into consideration, but the fact is there's nearly always two parents, whether that be same sex, mother and father and father, however it works. And the equality and the care they're receiving during conception, pregnancy, birth, and then after birth is far from equal. And it's far from what it should be, what it could be, but more importantly, what it needs to be. It doesn't meet the needs of the family. It doesn't meet the needs of these individuals. It is falling very short, and we are seeing the consequences of that, and COVID has highlighted the consequences and the disparities of the care that is currently there. A lot of the staff and the workforce are excellent. You know, a lot of them are really good and they are trying their best. But the fact is, they're working within systems that are bound by red tape and, you know, overloaded with paperwork already, and they just don't have the space to record the partner or the father's worries, or to do the assessments of dad to make sure that they are okay. And there isn't signposting when it comes to signposting. Grassroots, we've got lots of great grassroots, but again, postcode lottery, so staff haven't really got anywhere to signpost dads to get male specific paternal specific care.
I'm glad you mentioned signposting, because signposting seems to be like one of the biggest, when you say about that you know what needs to be done and you've recommended what needs to be done, but it's not been done. What I notice a lot is that there is a big kind of campaign as to we need to talk and it's good to talk and all the rest of it. But what I often find is, again, to talk of this kind of falling off a cliff that kind of men go through, that message falls off a cliff as well, because it's like, okay, so I speak to loads of people, I'm like, well, what next? What next? Yeah. No one's saying what next. They're all saying, oh, it's good to talk and it's really bad that men are committing suicide, and it's, we must bring suicide awareness to men's mental health and all the rest of it. And this comes across the political spectrum and whatever. But then when you say, well, what's next? All of a sudden it's like, well, it's just silence, you know what I mean?
Yeah, and this, and this is a problem.
Yeah, and this is the problem with the signposting. There's no sort of like, oh, okay, so I've talked. Okay, so should I talk again, or should I just
Well, it will shut people down, won't it? I'm just going to pick you up on your word, committed suicide there, though I have to do it. Everyone does it, so it's just completed suicide. No, it's fine. But, and that's what I say about it taking a long time for it to filter through in the language. But with regards to signposting, if somebody has opened up and then the services or the professional has kind of gone, haven't got anywhere to signpost you to, that has effectively built a brick wall up again, hasn't it, in front of that person, because they're like, why am I going to open up again? Why am I going to try and start this conversation again? Why am I going to try and reach out for help? Because I'm going to be met with the nothingness, the edge of the cliff again. And that's what we need the government to take notice of. We've got so many great grassroots. I know one of the Paternal Mental Health Alliance, Dads Matters, they want to get these services embedded within pathways so that there is somewhere to refer onto, and we've got the grassroots and the charities alongside or within the NHS pathway, so it is a seamless journey. And this needs to happen worldwide, really, but we'll just stay with nationwide for now. And this is something that really needs to happen. We've got the research to show that, the peer support works and the ongoing support works. We just need to get those with the powers that be to hear, to implement, and sadly to ring fence for money. A lot of it does generally come down to money. But in the context of money, if we have these services in place, we would effectively be able to pay for these services within probably a year or two with the amount of money saved. So put it into context with regards to suicide. The cost to the economy, I think it's 1.67 million per suicide. 72% of that is with bereavement care. So if we had services in place and it stopped 2 suicides a year, that's a lot of money to plough back in. There are huge savings to be made when you prevent as opposed to trying to pick up the pieces afterwards,
And the thing is as well is a lot of dads want to actually do... I'll give you an example. In a lot of the Facebook groups I'm on, if a guy says, I'm going through a rough time, generally you'll have a lot of people that will reply, but also a fair majority of them will be saying, DM me and I'll give you my number. So a lot of guys, actually, one of the things that men hate more than anything else is to see another man on their knees. And I think that this is kind of something that's kind of been missed a little bit, that actually you give guys who have been through it themselves or who have an understanding of the importance of men having their tribe or a group of guys around them, or what I would call like a 12 a.m. guy, i.e. someone that you ring in the middle of the night when things aren't great. You give men the tools to put this stuff in place, which can be as simple as, a pram walk or a snooker night or something where you've got a group of guys meeting up on a regular basis. If you put the infrastructure in place for that, it's, you almost wouldn't need to pay guys to do it. Most guys are not going to say, oh yeah, I'm not going to take a call from a guy in my community who's having a rough time of it. Most guys just simply aren't going to do that, I don't think. I think it's inbuilt into our kind of DNA, this need to help someone else in need, particularly if they're of the same sex as well. You know, by the way, I'm not going to talk to you because, So I think that could be leveraged as well.
Yeah, I mean, and if you kind of look at it and think of it, right, when you walk into a pub, quite often it's more males than females, and they're not standing there in silence. They will go in and strike up a conversation with a total stranger, or they'll just talk, and men are really good at talking if you actually take notice. They just do it instinctively, and like you say, they'll talk to another bloke. They just will, whereas quite often women, if you're out and about, you find it a lot harder actually to strike up a conversation with a random stranger about anything or nothing. But all the men I've been around, when you go out, I've met so many new people because they just go and talk to another man, or they'll just be standing next to the man at the bar. That's it, you know, they're talking. And you are great at starting conversations. You are great at having conversations. You are great at engaging and just talking. And that's what everyone says you can't do. If you look at society, you're really, really good at talking. And then it's like the staringly obvious is missed. And that just seems to be the case where things should be obvious and simple, yet it's made so hard and complicated by preconceptions, by misjudgments,
and a typical thing at the minute is, oh, men don't talk about how they should feel, therefore we need to make men more like women. And you just like, so that's the kind of what's happening at the minute. And you know, I know there are a few women that listen to the podcast, and in my experience, again, the women that I'm speaking to, they're saying, actually, no, I know my husband, he does speak, but he just does it in a different way. And, you know, he'll speak to his mate when he's playing golf, or he'll speak to his buddy when he's fishing, or he'll speak to someone in the pub or whatever. They are speaking, but they just do it in a different way. And the thing is, again, this speaks to what we were saying at the beginning, this kind of homogenization of, oh, yeah, men and women are kind of diametrically the same. They're not. They are similar, but there are differences. And this kind of like, you're wrong for being a man doesn't help. It doesn't really help the discussion at all, sort of thing. In fact, in some ways, it makes it worse.
In one way, you need to do it like this.
Yeah.
Just however it comes out.
Yeah. Yeah. It is a frustrating discussion to get into. So we've sort of touched upon your experience and what you're finding in this kind of space at the moment. What do you think are some practical things that, I'm going to go through a few different scenarios with you. So if you are a relative of, say your brother's just had kids, or your a wife or partner, and you've just given birth, the man in your life, be it brother, husband, partner, whatever it's going to be, what sort of things do you need to be doing on a kind of practical level to not necessarily detect whether or not they're going through a bad time, but actually kind of begin to open up these kind of channels of communication and stuff? Helen, what do you think?
Well, I mean, the obvious one is talk. Just talk and ask questions directly. You're not going to put anything in anyone's mind if you ask direct questions. And I mean, specifically for suicides as well, this is research and a known fact that you're not going to put the thoughts into someone's head if you directly ask, do you have a plan to end your own life? Are you thinking of completing suicide? And it's the same for mental health. You can't put it into somebody's head. You're not going to make them ill by asking, how are you sleeping? How are you finding it with the baby? What's it like being a dad? But I mean, we don't have to focus on all the bad things. It's about engaging on, you know, you're all right, mate. How is it? What's it like being a dad again? You know, what's it like being a dad? Well, what them nappies like? You know, just any conversation. It's literally just talking. And like you say, men are good at talking. So offer. You're right. Do you want to come out? You know, do you want to go for a stroll, take the baby for a walk? Or, you know, do you want to come out for just a quick half a pint just to get out? just what you'd normally do, but just with slightly smaller expectations on the amount of time that that person might have. Really, I mean, the Paternal Mental Health Alliance, we've done some great slides actually on the 10 best practices for professionals to engage dads in the conversation. And I think, I mean, a lot of it kind of crosses over, really. You know, you need to ask questions, you know, just start conversations, be aware of your own biases and marginalization, so how you think about what the dad should be doing, how the family dynamic should be working, and just bear in mind that just because you think that should be a certain way, that it's not always going to be. Each family is individual and different, and just recognize that, and don't try and put your own kind of biases, I suppose, on each individual and each family. You know, you need to empower each other. And I think men are really good at that. And I don't think you'd really use the word empowerment necessarily, but you kind of unconsciously do it just through your conversations and just through the kind of the friendships that men have. And when you watch, you know, men who have really good, strong relationships, it's we could learn a lot from you, you know, and we should be learning a lot from you going forward. It's just talking and just engaging, isn't it, really? You know, and celebrating the fact that you're there in the family and celebrating what dad's done, you know, because when mums do a thing, they quite often get, oh, yeah, you know, well done, or you've done this. It's exactly the same for dads. You know what I mean? If he's just learned to do the nappy, well done, mate. And it's just, you know, the same for mums. It's a whole thing. If you've just learned how to, I don't know, do the car seat. Because, my God, those things are a nightmare. Celebrate that, really. It's just, just treat them like you normally would, but just ask questions and talk.
Yeah, we have, funny enough, we have in Guild of Dads Facebook group, we have weekly wins, and guys can just put on there what their wins for the week have been and stuff. Yeah. And that, again, it's an opportunity for other men to give them some props as to, you know, and it could be the smallest little thing, but it could be getting a promotion at work or whatever and stuff. But one thing I notice, one thing I come across a lot, and is what I would call parental martyrdom. And it's this idea that the family can't function without me unless I'm present and stuff. And this is for men and women. And I think as parents, we've got into this idea of no one can look after my kids like I can. And one thing I encourage guys to do is actually to go out by themselves, away from, and go and do your, go fishing, go and play golf with your mate, or do whatever you're going to do, but have that time away from the family, but also encourage your wife to do the same. And to bring it all together, you go out on a date night now and again, you know, and once it's difficult in those first, I don't know, it's difficult probably why my mum's expressing, for instance, but once you've got that down, you know, you can still go out for a meal. It's giving yourself the permission to actually, and then you connect and stuff, and you know, Nan and Granddad, I'm sure they're a little bit annoying sometimes, but they did have you once, so they are able to cope for a couple of hours. Nothing's going to go catastrophically wrong, but giving yourself the permission and giving your wife the permission to take time out individually, but take time together as well. And I think that's the one thing missing.
Give yourself a break as well, isn't it? Give yourself a break. Like you say, if the house or whatever, and you don't, especially for dads, what I would love to be able to say to my partner is, yeah, you know, it would be great if you could do, you know, provide like you wanted to. But you know, the one thing that I want more than anything, and the one thing I would give anything to have, would be just to have time with you. Don't feel like you have got to be sole earner, provider, everything. You've got to be the rock. You've got to be the money. You've got to be this. I can almost guarantee you the one thing that your partner and your children want is you. And that is so important for dads. And I suppose that kind of falls back to finding the new identity, doesn't it? Because before, your identity might have been the job, or, you know, provider of the great holidays and all of this sort of stuff. And all of a sudden it's changed. And it is, that does take a lot of processing, and I can't imagine how you do work through that. But just allowing yourself to, okay, that actually, you know, the £1,000 pushchair or whatever, do you know what I mean? It will happen, it will come, it will whatever. And even if it's not that pushchair, it's fine. I can guarantee you, they want you, Dad, more than they want the things and the stuff.
Yeah, and that's one thing I say is that children want your presence, not your presence. Yeah. And
I'd give anything for my children to be able to have their dad there. I'd rather have him with no money, with, I don't know, in a shelter somewhere, all of us, but we'd be together, you know, and they'd have that. They'd have both of us, and you know, they'd, you know, instead of when we talk about dads, my dad's dead. I know, because it's so matter of fact for them. I'd give anything to change that. So if, you know, any dads that are kind of struggling a bit, and it makes me tear up a bit actually, you know, who might be watching, we just want you. And not having you around because things got so hard, because, you know, we haven't got the skills or the services or you know, anything out there at the minute to help kind of break this, just know we just want you.
And that is quite a powerful but also true statement to make, I think, as well. So if you are listening to this podcast, I would really listen to what Helen has just said there, and because it's this really speaks to the transition we've been talking about earlier on in the conversation as well, that part of becoming a dad is understanding that you can still have fun, you can still play Jack the Lad with your mates, and you can still do all these things, but it's embracing a new way of life, and it's embracing a way of life that sees you being present with your children, being fully aware when you're with them, and an actual fact, creating experiences and creating memories, because you don't need to be taking them to Chessington World of Adventures or spending money on days out or this and that. It's just you being there. And one of the things that I have discussed in the podcast previously, Helen, is this notion of the absent father. So even if you're there physically, but you're not there mentally, i.e. you're worrying about work or you're thinking about something else, one of the biggest things that you can kind of cultivate as a dad is this ability to be fully present and fully engaged when you are there, for your own benefit as well as for your wife and your partner and your family's benefit. So
absolutely.
Helen, it's been an absolute pleasure speaking to you today. And I want to thank you for sharing your story. I know it's been difficult at times re-going over it and stuff and that, but I think that one of the things that I admire about you the most is that you've taken what was a, you know, intolerable situation, but you've been able to pivot it around and flip it around, and now you're doing stuff to help prevent stuff like this happening again. And so I do have to take my hat off to you on that one. So
thank you so much, Jodo. That means a lot. And it was a great conversation. And it's part of the healing process as well, kind of making sure that things like this change. And also for me, just, you know, going over things, it's been really great. It's been fascinating. Another roller coaster. But I love those. No, honestly, thank you, Joe. It's been excellent. Really, really great. Thank you.
No worries. You've mentioned, dropped into the conversation, the work that you do. What is the best way for people to find out about what you do, link up with you, drop you a message or whatever? What's the best way to do so?
Twitter. So you can either look for the Paternal Mental Health Alliance on Twitter, or myself, Helen Birch, at We Can Do This Group. So Twitter's the best way to get me with anything professional that I'm doing.
All right, super. I'm going to ask you one last question before I bid farewell to you today, Helen. What is it in life that gives you meaning?
My children. 100%. I'm doing this all for them. So the future is a damn sight brighter than it is now with regards to bringing up families, having families, and mental health in general. Yeah.
I love it. And that doesn't come as any surprise to me. So, and it's important, the work that you're doing, most definitely, most definitely. Thank you very much for joining me today. And with that in mind, I wish you all the best.
Thank you so much.
Cheers. Thanks, Helen.
Bye.
A massive thanks to Helen for joining me. You can link up with her on Twitter, the Paternal Mental Health Alliance, and her personal profile is Helen Birch at We Can Do This GRP. Guild of Dads is about men and dads, but I'm also indebted to the women and mums that come on to the podcast now and again to share their stories, like Helen, because it illustrates just how much of an impact dads have in their families' lives and just what an impact losing them has. It strengthens my conviction that if Guild of Dads is a worthwhile pursuit for me, then it will also impact dads and families on a deep level. These conversations are hard and uncomfortable and ultimately sad. But what I really love about Helen is that she has transformed her grief into a positive force of change so that things will change for dads, that other women and children may one day not find themselves in the position she was. And for that, I have to take my hat off to her. She's a formidable woman doing incredible things. If you want to link up with me, you can do so. Instagram or Facebook using the handle @GuildofDads. Let me know what resonated about this episode. Have you had suicidal ideation? Have you been close to taking your own life? Let me know what resonates. Did I mention that you can now buy me a coffee on my website, guildofdads.com? It's really easy and helps me keep the lights on here at Guild of Dads Towers. Just head on over to guildofdads.com, click the coffee cup button and go for it. By the way, if you do so, I will give you a quick shout out on the podcast and also in my community, the Guild of Dads Facebook group. Now, in order to have a positive impact on the world, we improve ourselves and inspire others. Share this podcast with others so that they may benefit from anything you have found useful or interesting. And gents, this is as easy as hitting the share button, putting in the names of 5 other men and saying, hey, check this out. Use the hashtag Guild of Dads on social media and tag me in. I will shout you out. The other thing you can do is leave a rating and review on Apple Podcasts, which really helps other dads to find the podcast. Right now, the Guild of Dads Facebook group is growing fast, very fast. In fact, we're up to 1,600 members at the last count. So if you want to get on board, head on over there and join up today, where you can get around a lively group of other guys talking everything about being a dad and improving themselves as men and dads. Hopefully, you find something insightful in every episode. So share with dads you know. And in the meantime, live a life of vision, action, and meaning. Apply what you hear, and we'll see you next time.